Hey, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix. This is the show. This is the hour where you are invited to fly out of the box of convention, if you're still in it, and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone where everything is possible and where you understand you create it all anyway. And today's very special because I have on the air a man who, boy, talk about soul family reconnecting. This is Stephen Mailer. I had him on twice already some time ago talking about our beloved Hakim, the wisdom keeper of the Kamishan tradition, who passed in August. And we had one a little bit poignant show. We got Ben in the second one. We got into the Kamishan wisdom. I have to say that Stephen is most likely the carrier of the wisdom of Hakim, and doing his best to honor Hakim and to continue to bring that light through to us. But tonight and today, tonight here, today where you are, Stephen is going to be talking about his new book. It's called The Crystal Skulls, Astonishing Portals to Man's Past. And those of you who are my audience know this is a subject area that is very, very important to me and has been for so many years. But before I do bring in Stephen, I just want to tell you a little bit more about him. He, as I said, he is the wisdom carrier, the torch carrier for my beloved Hakim. He wrote a book, in fact, with Hakim called The Land of Osiris, in which he brings forward all of that incredible wisdom. He wrote another book called From Light into Darkness. And this book, The Crystal Skulls, which is co-authored with David Hatcher Childress, who many of you are probably familiar with as well. So tonight I've asked him, let's blow the lid off and let's just go as wild as possible with the whole concept of the crystal skulls and with a particular eye for truth and grounded information and not some of the speculation and really weigh out declarations that some people are making. And that would include me because I certainly have my opinions about the crystal skull phenomenon in the Mayan tradition. And still, I try, and Stephen and I, we don't agree about everything, but I try to bring forward all the perspectives, all of the knowledge I can gather. And who greater than Stephen Mailer, a man I deeply, deeply respect. Hiya, Stephen.
Hi, Patricia. Nice to talk to you again.
You too. I hope that wasn't too much of a eulogy for you.
Not at all.
You can handle it?
Oh, yes. And I really appreciate our connection, because as we have found out over these past months, we have so many deep connections on so many deep levels. It started with the fact of Hakim's passing, bringing us together, but then finding out that we lived in the same towns around the world at the same time, and this deep connection with crystal skulls, which we'll go into tonight, which is not unrelated to our interest in ancient Egypt, too.
In fact, if you really look at it, I mean, of course, I think we both can agree that we have a serious connection, no pun intended.
Seriously, right.
Very seriously. And it's so delightful because, of course, my work is working with the Syrian information, and I have the great joy and honor of connecting with lots of people who are attracted to my work, as I'm sure is the same with you, and then unfolds this incredible sense of having that Syrian star system in our DNA.
Yes,
so it seems to all be related together: Egypt, the skulls, the mind. In fact, I look at your programs and your schedule, and we seem to always be headed toward the same places at the same times as well.
Absolutely, and what makes this interview even fresher and more vital is I now have read your first two channeled books from the Syrian masters, and so I, as well as you now having read my books, I know what is you've channeled through about skulls and about Sirius, and so we can get, you know, we can talk about that in much greater detail, that we both know what we're both putting about it. And as you said, a lot of the material about crystal skulls is speculation. I mean, we can talk facts, we can talk about the history and the actual data and evidence that we have, but when it comes down to crystal skulls, so much of it becomes subjective, because as you have channeled about them, many people have channeled them, I've channeled with them, it seems like everybody that gets around a crystal skull starts channeling. So we can separate some of that information, but it will be that there is no real truth here. I mean, we can put down the evidence, we can talk about the things, that, I mean, the fact that I've been involved with them for now 30 years, but it comes down to, you know, it'll be opinion, it'll be idea, it'll be how people resonate to what we say. So, you know, we can say this and we can say that, but a lot of it is so much speculation, a lot of it is so much right brain as opposed to left brain, so that we can just present it and let people decide for themselves.
That's right. But what's exciting and important is to do that. I mean, I am a right brain person all the way, but I do try to honor the left brain people and merge these two aspects of the human mind together so that we can, and in fact, we're living at this moment when it's all coming together into one beautiful, balanced male-female mind, and the skull really does represent that, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. They were actually, you know, essential tools for the ancient peoples. Whoever created them, we can talk about who, but what we know is the why is that crystals definitely are devices for connection for interdimensional energies. For not
indeed.
Only
and, you know, it's just amazing. I mean, you mentioned our link at the beginning of the conversation, but goodness sakes, I mean, you were directing the Rosicrucian Museum headquarters about three blocks away from where I lived back in the 80s.
The thing is, I got involved in crystal skulls in first 1979, 1980, and there you were, living just a few blocks from Rosicrucian Park where I first got involved with them. So it is a pretty amazing synchronicity.
It is, and that's not the only amazing thing. The other amazing thing is that the first time I ever laid eyes on, in this lifetime, on a crystal skull was way before anybody ever heard of them. First of all, let's see, I think it was it was probably the same year that you were getting your hands on them, and I found the most outrageously beautiful smoky quartz human-sized skull in this obscure crystal shop in the Bay Area. And at the time, it was $500. God, today, it would probably be $10,000.
I'm sure.
But at the time, $500 for me was big bucks. Still is. And I got, unfortunately, I was with my mother, who is, you know, always the rational one. And I said, you know, I've got to have this skull. And she said, you don't have money for bus fare. Be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I left it. And I still... It still talks to me. It had an incredible rainbow fracture right at the third eye.
Right.
It was amazing. And that was the first really big moment when I knew, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and you know, you're connected. And this is a very typical story that we hear from people. We always have said that we don't go to crystal skulls. They call us. They seem to have, you know, this other ability to know who are crystal people, who are skull people, who are connected. So that skull was calling you. So it was almost like you were imperative that you had to get it. And it's been the same with me. I mean, they pull you to them. And I've heard so many stories from so many people that are the same, that they go into a shop having no idea about crystals, no idea about skulls. All of a sudden, they see a skull, and boom, their life has changed, and they have to have it. And the skull calls to them and talks to them and then tells them its name, and et cetera, et cetera. And as you know, people develop a personal relationship with them. They're not just little objects out of inanimate, inorganic material that sit on a shelf and are nice to look at. We actually develop personal, intimate relationships with them.
Right, and it's funny that you say you have to have them, because when I first got my first crystal skull, my partner Franco just said, why do we have to have this in the house? Because he's Italian, and these symbols for them are very different, very frightening and very dark, you know, because of the Catholic the religious influence.
Exactly.
Here.
Exactly.
And I said, I have to have this skull. Like you just said, I can't explain it, I just have to have it. So
right.
Just let
right.
It go.
That's right.
And of course, I'm sure like you too, I now have a committee of skulls here. One of which, you know, is most likely a very, very ancient Tibetan
skull. Yes, a
skull.
Very interesting skull, and I'm very glad you sent me photographs of it. There's been rumors for years, and this is, you know, part of what we can talk about, rumors of where they came from, et cetera, to Atlantis, et cetera. There's been all these stories that there were 13 skulls that came from Tibet, very ancient skulls. And for years, people have been talking about this skull maybe from Tibet, that skull maybe from Tibet, but there's been nothing definitive about them. However, you know, yours looks like one definitely that could be a skull from Tibet. And we know that the ancient Tibetans were very interested in crystal and probably did a lot of crystal carving.
When I was in Tibet back in 1997, I went twice in 1 year, if you can imagine that.
Wow.
And it was before the Chinese really just wiped, I mean, of course there was Chinese influence, but it was before this huge opening with the Chinese influence that now has pretty much broken the energy there.
Yes.
And I found crystals in the weirdest places, I mean, in markets. And you can buy crystals in shops where they tell you that these are Tibetan crystals, but I know for certain that the crystals I bought there were Tibetan because I bought them in markets.
Yes.
And they
yes.
have such an incredible energy, very different if you're a crystal worker like you are and like
right.
I am, than
right.
a lot of other quartz that you work with.
Right. And again, it also depends on how they will work with, as we always talk with people about how we can tell an ancient one from more modern ones, from contemporary ones. It's sometimes it's aesthetic, how it's carved, what it looks like. More modern skulls, of course, are carved aesthetically pleasing with the finest quartz, finest crystal possible, made to look very much like a human skull. We can talk about the famous one before we're done. To be sold. I mean, they're carved basically for aesthetics. But the ancient ones, obviously, sometimes they look ugly, they look crude, because it's the intent of the carver. We say this over and over and over again. It's the intent of the carver. And so many of the ancient ones were not carved for aesthetics. They were chosen, the crystal was chosen for its intrinsic metaphysical qualities, and the skulls were used as powerful tools, meditation tools, devices, healing devices, et cetera, et cetera. So sometimes when you come across one like you did that may have been used very, very ancient in ritual, the energy involved with them is so different than you can tell from a modern contemporary skull. There's so much power. There's so much memory. There's so much human energy that's involved with them because they've interacted. They've been used in ritual. And this is how we determine, because I've been taught by masters how to do that, the real ancient ones. They're usually not aesthetically pleasing, not the finest quality quartz, but the energy and the power and the memory, because they've been used in ritual for so many thousands of years. And that's
in fact, this one has, when I first got this skull, which I admit I bought, it wasn't a gift, I bought it from an antique dealer in Vienna.
Mm.
And the story how I found him is quite bizarre. Someone sent me a picture of this amazing skull that had Tibetan ornamentation around it. Really, really, I've never seen anything like it before or since. This really incredible ornamental design around it with Tibetan, like Tibetan jewelry. It had coral in it and turquoise and Tibetan silver. And someone sent me the picture of it. It was in a museum showing somewhere in Austria, and I told the person that sent it to me, excuse me, I have to see this, absolutely must be with this skull. It also had, by the way, the separate jaw. And he investigated and found that the person who had supplied this to the show was this Austrian dealer.
Uh-huh.
And he went there and asked about it, and the guy said, oh, no, that skull is not for sale, and I don't know where it is, but why are you asking about it? And by the time the day was over, he came out with these other two skulls.
Mm.
And one of them was the one that I eventually purchased, and the other one went to this man who made the contact, which was much smaller than mine, but similar. And the dealer said, who, by the way, is a reputable dealer, told him that these were from the Himalayas and they were from Tibetan temples. And what's interesting about the skull is that it had a patina on it, which plenty of is still there because I haven't completely cleaned it. And I kind of like to see if I could get this patina, this material, examined, because I'm quite sure it's going to have something like incense or yak butter, something on
yes.
it.
Yes. And actually, your skull looked, too, like it had been buried, like there's a lot of dirt and grit residue.
Yeah.
Like it might have been actually buried in the temple for a while.
Indeed. Now, it is really old.
With the bringing up your skull and how you got it in Vienna leads to, you know, what we could talk about the known history that we have. crystal skulls really exploded on the European scene, and that's why it's very possible to find some real ancient skulls or some interesting skulls in all throughout Europe, particularly Austria and Germany, because crystal skulls really explode on the European scene in the middle of the 19th century when the Austrian Emperor Maximilian had conquered Mexico. This is 1840s, 1850s. And so then the Germans came into Europe, particularly into Brazil, started mining quartz and getting crystals, and there was a great interest in crystal skulls in Europe in the late 19th century. So this is really why there are probably a lot of them in collectors in Europe, and that's why it's a good place to locate them, because they really started coming out of Mexico in the Mayan tombs and Aztec tombs and Olmec tombs, and that's when they really exploded on the European scene. But before, a couple of hundred years ago, very few people in the West knew anything about them.
Indeed. In fact, I would say 10 years ago, nobody even talked about skulls except a few of us,
Well, we did. I would say before the gentleman I'm going to talk about, Nick Nocerino, came on the scene, before the 50s, there were very few people who knew about skulls. Of course, the famous Mitchell Hedges skull comes into play. There were people who knew that. Like I said, there were a lot of these adventures, like Mike Mitchell Hedges was, who had gone to Central America and Mexico, and they started, the shamans had crystal skulls. There were crystal skulls coming out of tombs. And so that's when it really exploded on the scene. But I would say before the 19th century, there were very few people in Europe, in the West, who knew anything about them. The Mayans did.
So why did you, I would like to be clear about why you think it particularly exploded in Europe.
Again, because they were suddenly discovering South America and Central America. Because you had, the Germans have always been some of the leading archaeologists in European history, and the Italians. And so the Germans started going into Brazil, into South America. Again, Maximilian, Austrian Emperor, had Mexico. And so they were looting tombs. They started to loot tombs throughout Central America and Mexico, and they discovered crystal skulls. And then they started to bring them back to Europe, and then they started to carve them in Europe. People realized that Europeans might find them interesting, might want to have some on their little personal collections. So they started carving crystal skulls carving crystal. We don't know for sure about the carving crystal skulls. It's very interesting, and we can talk about this if you want to in detail about the Mitchell Hedges skull. But there was one particular city in Germany. It's a twin city now called Idar-Oberstein. There were separate cities before 1933. It was the Nazis that brought them together. But the city of Oberstein, Germany, has been the leading carving area of quartz in European history. And we believe that they may have carved crystal skull there. It has not been definitely proven yet, but there is no doubt that these German soldier fortunes, Austrian soldier fortunes, went to Mexico, went to Central America in the 1850s, 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, and then these crystal skulls start to appear in Europe and are being sold in private collections, particularly in the early part of the 20th century. A lot of skulls.
Well, this is what makes mine so interesting, because like you said, it's not a particularly attractive skull. And so this dealer had these skulls packed away, and it was only because this friend of mine insisted, talking about the quest for crystal skulls and whatever, that he said, "I've got something to show you." And he brought them out, and he said, "I don't have these out for just anyone, but I have a sense that they you need to see them."
Yeah.
And
it's
interesting to be able to
tell them that.
Sorry?
Yeah, and again, it's when I look at a skull, and again, you know, to be honest, we always tell people, well, to make a final, you know, really strong determination, of course you have to experience the skull. I have to see it,
have
to observe it, have to look at it like a scientist with a magnifying glass, and then meditate with it to really get
meditate with it above all else.
Of course. But when you look at pictures, I can get a good sense right away because of my experience with them. And when I see some of them crude like that, some of them unpolished like that, and things like that, you tend to want to think this is not modern. Again, because modern skulls, particularly those that have been carved in the last 10, 20, 50 years, are being carved to be sold. So they're going to be beautifully good piece of quartz, very smooth,
right.
And a really good attempt to be anatomically correct as far as a human skull goes, et cetera, et cetera. Now, of course, the great anomaly that we can talk about is the Mitchell Hedges skull. This is the one that is the one that's most confusing for people. I think it's been the one that's been most misidentified, been confused. And it's because it's so exquisite, it's so beautiful. And yet, you know, as we've talked about, there are those who channel that it's one of the original 13 skulls from Atlantis. I reject that, and we can discuss that, but it is something mm-hmm. that, you know, people have come across with it. I originally thought it was ancient myself when I first worked with it, because it's very powerful. Very powerful.
It is very powerful. I've meditated with it, and I think you have too.
Many times.
And so, of course, we're going to both agree on one very central thought. And that is that if enough people meditate with a piece of quartz and empower it with that kind of wisdom, in essence, it also resonates to that much love and adoration and intellect.
That's really one thing we should establish right from the get-go, so that people don't miss, because people tend to misunderstand when I get into that type of discussion about the skulls. All quartz is ancient. All quartz
exactly.
is billions of years old. Unless it's synthetically
exactly.
produced in a laboratory, all quartz is ancient. All quartz has energy. All quartz can be programmed. All quartz can be used for healing, for storing of information, and
exactly.
for communication on an interdimensional extraterrestrial level. So all quartz fits that level. And then again, you can even take a modern skull, put it with an ancient skull, and it's like I often say to people, the ancient skulls can be thought of as mainframe computers, has all the hard drive, all the memory. You can take any piece of quartz that's clean, that someone has cleared, and I can explain how we actually do that metaphysically, how you can clear a piece of quartz so that it has no memory anymore. But you can take any piece of quartz, any skull that could be carved last week, you put it with a Max, a Shana Ra, maybe with your skull. And immediately the older one will download to the younger. It's a basic
That's right.
Law
and
yes,
if I can just interject something here. You and I have both also knew Marcel Vogel, which is another
right.
incredible connection.
I was
and Marcel
talk,
Vogel,
yes.
for the people that don't know who he was the developer of liquid crystal silicon.
Actually, he got his PhD in liquid crystallography. He was a PhD in chemistry.
He contributed this knowledge to IBM. That's how he made his money.
Yes.
Before
I can talk a lot about him. He was
the first to dedicate himself to healing.
Yes. He was the first great one that I worked with. I worked with the two giants in the field. Both have passed away. Dr. Marshall J.
Vogel
and Mr. F.R. Nick Nocerino. Huh? Excuse me?
I didn't know that you worked with Vogel with crystals.
Oh, sure. Vogel was the first. He came into the Rosicrucian lab when I first worked with the first crystal skull, which is 29
cool
years
is
ago.
That? Well,
January,
I worked with, I think I told you this, his assistant, his name was Dick Ball. And if you remember, I said, what kind of a name is that?
Oh, yeah. Well, Marcel Vogel lived just a couple of blocks from Rosicrucian Park. I was to his house. I worked with two crystal skulls with him, what we call the Mayan crystal skull and the Amethyst crystal skull.
Right.
I actually have both recorded on audio tape. Marcel was great. Vogel was the first great scientist that I worked with because he was able, as I do, to walk in both worlds. He was, as you mentioned, PhD in chemistry, worked for IBM as a senior scientist at IBM for over 25 years, worked on liquid phosphorescence of crystals. He wrote many great papers on the subject. He produced scientific theories, which are in my book, which I actually use his series of his scientific theories, how quartz can store information, is valuable today to anyone. He also was, of course, a Rosicrucian, so he could walk in both worlds. And then, of course, the greatest source on the subject was Mr. Nick Nocerino, who also was one of the greatest metaphysical parapsychologists who ever lived, knew more about crystal skulls than anybody who's ever lived.
And how unfortunate for me, I have to say, because I was right there in San Francisco Bay Area,
and I had not one but two
appointments with Nick, and both of them fell through for various reasons. I just missed having the chance to talk and meet and hopefully work with him.
I have regrets too that I didn't spend more time with him. There was different reasons, and I don't want to get into personalities and conflicts and politics. that I didn't spend more time with him than I wished I could have, but I treasured the time I was with him, and the information he gave me was superlative. And he had worked, of course, with the Mayan shamans, had gone through Mexico. We can talk in detail about the Mayan connection, but he also...
Okay, well, let's start by talking about, because most people don't really know about Nick, and, you know, let's be honest, there are a few names that are out there right now as the people or the voices for the Crystal Skulls, and quite honestly, I think that we can't talk about anyone as a knowledgeable exponent of Crystal Skull information without first talking about Nick Nocerino. So if you could give a little oversight
not.
About
that. In fact,
this
one of my favorite Nick quotes is that he used to say, the more I study Crystal Skulls, the less I know about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, was his great humility. There was nobody who knew more about him than he did. But that was the truth. I mean, it's a lifelong study. The more you work with Crystal Skulls, I mean, you never can come to the end of the information and the knowledge about them. But again, it is Vogel, and it happens to be by default that I now am one of the senior researchers in the field. There's actually maybe one other person who's a student of Nick's who I would say has been involved with Crystal Skulls longer than I have. But since they both have passed away, and I first got involved in 1979, first saw my first Crystal Skull, January 4th, 1980, 29 years now. So I actually, by, you know, just I'm still around, that I'm one of the senior researchers in the field. But
that's amazing. That is about the time that I was walking away from the beautiful smoky quartz crystal. That was the time.
That's, you know, I first met
you
in 1983.
It's getting pretty creepy here.
Well, Nick Nocerino was the first person in the West who gave a public lecture about crystal skulls in March of 1980. To tell Nick's story, I mean, we could go on for hours, but, you know, it's interesting you talked about the fact that you're in Italy and you're married to an Italian. Nick, of course, was an Italian-American who was raised in a typical, you would think typical, Italian Catholic family. However, the difference with Nick and the difference why he was who he was in that his maternal grandmother was a Wiccan high priestess, and there was a tradition of Wicca in his family. And she was called, in Italian, Strega o Stregoni, which means Wiccan high priestess. And he also had a woman who was named Comadre, who was a teacher of his. So when Nick was a small boy, in fact, the story even starts with his birth, and it's a great story that the family allowed me to put in the book, that when Nick was born, he was born on the kitchen table in his family home in Brooklyn, and all his grandmother and her coven served as the midwives for his birth. So immediately from his entrance into the world, he wasn't brought in as a typical Italian Catholic. He was brought in under...
I'd say not.
...of Wicca.
And as I recall in the book, you talk about the fact that he had crystals around him at the birth table. Is that right?
Yes. Well, what they did was, as soon as he was born, according to Wiccan tradition, they did not discard the placenta. The placenta was given to this lady who was known as Comadre, very close friend, a Wiccan high priestess, a friend of his grandmother. She took the birth placenta, put it in a mason jar with a bunch of small quartz crystals to be charged by his birth placenta energy, the connection from his mother's energy, and they believed it was because of the ancestors' energy would all come through it. And so then when he was 8 years old, he was told to go to this lady's house. He knew nothing up until that point, except the fact that he was born very psychic, very sensitive. He just assumed everybody was, but he was extremely sensitive. He was already in communication with spirit before he was 8 years old. But when he went to her house, she gave him the crystals to wear around his neck, then discarded the placenta, so then he would wear the birth crystals around his neck as power, as protection. He was then taught about the use of crystals, how to use crystals in healing, what crystals were about. So he started out from a young age, 8, 9 years old. He already knew about crystals. At 9 years old, when he had his first vision of a crystal skull in his home in Brooklyn, he was walking up the stairs to the second floor landing. There was a large mirror on the second floor. He coming up the stairs, he looked in the mirror and immediately saw a skull appear in the mirror. Now, of course, being that he had the Wiccan background and already had his experiences, he wasn't frightened. He looked in the mirror, and he saw that the skull was not a human skull, that it was a crystal skull. He then saw two very significant things. He saw a snake come out of one eye, a cobra come out of one eye, and then he saw a jaguar come out of the other eye. And he never forgot that image. In fact, he had somebody draw it down later. It's later that he found out when he connected with the Maya, that it's called, that is known as the clan of the Jaguar, or the order of the Jaguar, who are those who keep the knowledge about crystal skulls among the Maya.
And can I interject to you that I am of the Jaguar clan?
Excuse me? Go ahead.
Can I interject here that I also have a connection with the Jaguar clan, and I'm sure you do too?
Yes, go ahead.
No, I'm saying you do also have this.
As it turns out, that image led Nick to go to Mexico in the late 40s. He then sought out the Jaguar clan, connected with the Jaguar clan, and then the gentleman that we got involved with who brought in the crystal skulls, we call the Mayan crystal skull and the Amethyst crystal skull, and I can mention his name now because I think he's no longer with us. His name is Francisco Reyes. He claimed to be a priest in both the Aztec and Jaguar tradition. He was of the Jaguar clan. So I connected with him in 1983.
Very interesting.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm just putting together the dates because I'm wondering, since I find that you and I are always in sync, I'm wondering
where
I was.
Well, this is interesting. I think you already had gone to Italy in 1983, hadn't you?
In 1983 is when I came to Italy.
Yes, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's when I came back to it.
So that's when Francisco, when I met Francisco, ironically enough, you were almost still there. I met Francisco in November of 1982 when he brought in the Amethyst skull. I met him personally. Then I met him again in the early spring of 1983 where we did a ritual together with the Amethyst skull. So you probably were then gone, but that's when Francisco was right there at Ram Metaphysical Bookstore down the street from where you live.
Down the street from me, that is too wild. All right, let's talk about now. You've talked about your own experience with the Amethyst skull, and I would like you to please just overview for us the skulls that you feel in your experience and your work with him that are, let's say, I don't care about the original Atlantean skull conversation. That to me is sort of
that's okay. I think we can bring that up. It's okay. I mean, I think we need to discuss that, and I'd like to discuss that in its perspective. But again, to put it, at first, I was working at Rosicrucian Park as a staff research scientist in November of 1979. We got a notice from the gentleman who was curator of the Rosicrucian Egyptian Museum. He had been contacted by a gentleman in San Jose, California named John Zamora, who said he had an object he would like us to look at to see if we could authenticate, document, and maybe even exhibit in the Rosicrucian Egyptian Museum. Of course, as it turned out, this gentleman, John Zamora, was an agent for these Mayans in Mexico who were trying to sell some antiquities, black market antiquities, and they were trying to use me and the Rosicrucian Order as agents to try to help them to do that. But what first was brought to us was a series of photographs. And again, this was it for me. As an archaeologist, as a prehistorian, I had heard about crystal skulls. I had probably seen pictures of Mitchell Hedges' skull in a book, but it had not really resonated with me at that point, not really sunk in. When I first looked at these photographs in November 1979 of what was then we now call the Mayan crystal skull, which was named by Nick Nocerino, and I'll explain why, but the Mayan crystal skull, it made a real deep impression on me. I said, whoa! This is something else. I would really like to work with this. So we asked this gentleman if he could bring the skull in for us to work with. He said, certainly. So again, that's where it starts. January 4th, 1980, I first experienced an ancient crystal skull. And it was ancient. The Mayan crystal skull was definitely ancient. We had very limited history of it. We believed it was told that it was found in a Mayan tomb in 1912 by a family of Mayans. They passed it down.
Okay, well, wait. What makes you say that it was definitely ancient?
Okay, because we'll work on it. The work that I did on it, the work Nick Nocerino on it. Now, Nick Nocerino, again, he first got involved with crystal skulls at the age of 9, saw his first crystal skull in the south of France in 1944, went to Mexico in the late 40s, saw many ancient skulls, crystal skulls. So by the time he comes into the 60s, 70s, I mean, this is the expert. He worked with this skull for 4 months. His group, he went to Mexico. He met this gentleman, Francisco Reyes, in the Oaxaca area, and I mention that to you because you know Mexico and have been there. This gentleman was located in the Oaxaca area where a lot of skulls have come out of. The Amethyst skull came out of Oaxaca. And he came, Nick went, met him, they connected. Nick paid his expenses to come to the U.S. if he could bring the skull in. This is another one of those amazing things that we could talk about. How did this gentleman, a Mayan priest, a very poor, not very well-heeled Mayan priest, able to come in and out of Mexico and U.S., bringing crystal skulls, and he was never checked at customs once? Now, I know exactly how to put it in. I'm not going to say that. But they amazingly, he came back and forth with all these crystal skulls. So Nick paid the expenses. He came to the U.S. in October 1979, and Nick's group, Nick had founded in New York City in 1944, later incorporated in California in 1945, an organization he called Society of Crystal Skulls International. Until it's the Nick's passing in 2004 and the disbanding of this organization, the Society of Crystal Skulls International was the most reputable, the most scientific, the most long-lasting organization to study crystal skulls. So Nick founded that organization and developed all students. He became the first person to get a credential to teach parapsychology in the state of California in 1950.
I know, that is pretty remarkable. That says so much about Nick Nazareno.
Oh, there's so much we could go on. He was featured in Search Of. He was on the Johnny Carson show. He was known as an original Ghostbuster. He used to be a person that people would call in who had hauntings, who had spirits that needed to be dealt with.
He was amazing. All right, but let's get back to the skulls.
To answer your question, I'm just trying to get to the point. Nick worked with the skull for 4 months. He was convinced it was ancient. I worked with it. Again, I had a whole full-day session with it, with Marcel Vogel. Marcel Vogel immediately pronounced it as ancient working with it. It was just as I worked with it, as I gathered data, and I did it scientifically. I had many, many people work on the skull, not in presence of another. We had questionnaires that people filled out. We record audio recording. I have hours and hours of audio recording of people working with crystal skulls.
Kind of information came forward?
Well, what was consistent was that people would see Mayan scenes. Would see consistently, that was like 80% of respondents would see Mayan scenes in it. That's why, because the majority of students saw Mayan scenes, he called it the Mayan crystal skull. It was a cloudy quartz skull, about 5 inches high, weighed a good 10 pounds, had particular indentations on the side, which was very, there's been a couple of skulls like that, so it was obviously that they were all carved by the same group of people. They would have these real interesting on the sides where our side of our head is, where our temporal lobes are. It was like indentations. The amethyst skull was like that too. So it was particular. The teeth were crude. The carving was good though. It was finely smooth and we saw so many scenes in it. I saw a lot of Mayan scenes in it. It had a lot of high energy around it. So I came to the conclusion that this was a genuine ancient artifact. I now know, of course, so much more now because that was the first one I worked with. I would still classify it as an ancient artifact, but not as old as some the others we could talk about. So there's like different degrees.
Well, let's talk about the others.
Yes. Well, Nick Nocerino, again, and the Society of Crystal Skulls International came up with the scientific means to classify them. He broke it down into three levels. What we would call a contemporary skull is one that's been carved in the last 50 to 100 years. And the overwhelming majority of crystal skulls you'll see out there, owned by people who claim that they are ancient, are contemporary skulls carved in the last 50 to 100 years. It's very easy to determine that, and we can go into detail. Then we classify what we call an old skull is more than 100 years old, carved within the last couple hundred years old. But what we classify an ancient crystal skull is one that's actually been carved into a skull over 1,000 years ago. So
okay.
I would classify the Mayan crystal skull as being carved over 1,000 years ago as a skull. So after I worked with that one, I became very friendly with this gentleman, John Zamora. He stayed in contact with me. I left the Rosicrucian Order, was no longer involved with them as a staff research scientist, but John contacted me again. Again, this is November 1982, and said the priest was there, had come in, and had another skull. Would I be interested to see it? I said, would I be interested to see it? Is the Pope Catholic? You know, and of course, sorry. I rushed to his house, and there was an amethyst crystal skull. Totally blew my mind. Now, again, I had not yet met Nick Nocerino, so I was not aware at this time that there were many amethyst skulls out there. I had never heard of that. We did have visions when people work with the Mayan skull of skulls of different colors, but I didn't conceive of them being all of different colored crystals. Now I know, I can tell you that there have been crystal skulls carved in every possible stone you can think of, from emerald, from ruby, from diamond, and of course in gold and silver. So there's crystal skulls.
I even used to have a little small crystal skull, of course contemporary, carved out of moldavite.
Moldavite. Ooh, that would be very nice. That's the extraterrestrial stone. That would
yes,
be a very
that was a very beautiful, but it leaped out of my, it was a very small one, and as you know how expensive moldavite is.
Oh, yeah.
It was a very expensive, self-indulgent moment when I purchased this little crystal skull of moldavite. And
well,
it
you
was
want to
so
talk about it.
Powerful, I can't even tell you.
Let me tell you that recently, within the last 6 months, there's been advertised a diamond-encrusted skull on sale for $10 million.
Oh, how diamond-encrusted, or I could understand it was a raw diamond that had been carved.
No, it's not one. Of course, the major part of the skull was not diamond. It would be more than $10 million, but it's diamond-encrusted all around it, and it's on sale for $10 million. Okay, so here I am. I look at an amethyst skull, and amethyst is my favorite stone. So I immediately freaked out with this one. I loved it. And so there I met Francisco Reyes, and I can talk to him more about that. He told me so much about crystal skulls and the Mayan tradition of crystal skulls. We're going to return to him. He gave me much information. And the amazing thing, Pat, as I know you have experienced in Egypt and in Mexico, I don't speak Spanish. I speak very little Spanish. Francisco didn't speak any English at all. And so John Zamora served as an interpreter. Yet there were times, and you know the Mayans can do this, when he would look at me and he would say something in Spanish, I knew exactly what he was saying in my mind, and I didn't understand the Spanish. He had that ability. He demonstrated that ability to be telepathic, you know, that ability to connect. And in fact, Marcel Vogel said that one of the major uses of the ancient crystal skull, particularly the Mayan skull, was as a language decoder. In other words, you could have a crystal skull in front of you and have people from all different cultures speaking all different languages, but through the use of the crystal skull, everybody would know what everybody else is saying. And this is almost like Star Trek.
Well, you know that I agree with you that we're talking, even if we talk about the Atlantic crystal skulls, it's so such a metaphor. I mean, you look at the possibility of 13 crystal skulls being united and that the 13th is a sort of master skull or a hologram, is just what I present in my material. When they're all together, it activates. And how much closer than a big, how perfectly this describes some kind of ancient computer network.
Yes, yes. And let's talk about
so
that.
I really
let's talk about the idea of 13 original skulls. We all had visions. Now, instead of saying I don't agree with it and it's wrong, no, that's not what we're going to say. Let's put some perspective on it. Before, Nick Nocerino was the first one in contemporary who mentioned seeing visions of 12 skulls in a circle with a master 13th in the middle. He mentioned that, he started talking about that in the 70s and 60s and 70s before anybody else was talking about them. Now, just to point out, to you know, put it in perspective, when I discussed skulls with Francisco Reyes in 1983, he never mentioned any Mayan tradition of there being 13 original skulls that had to come together. Now, that doesn't mean that there wasn't one, but he never discussed it. No one else contemporary has discussed this. You did 10 years ago. People started to talk about this in the late 80s, in part of the 90s. People started talking about seeing visions of 13 skulls, 13 skulls. So then the idea came up. Now, I'm not saying that it's wrong, but then the idea started to be channeled from different people before you that there were 13 original skulls, 13 master skulls that had to come together. Now, I'm really curious to ask you, if any of the contemporary, because I know you have now been initiated into the Mayan wisdom tradition in Mexico, if you've spoken to, because this was one of the reasons I wanted to go this year, was going to do a tour and connect with the Mayan shamans, because I've only spoken to two. I spoke to Francisco Reyes, and there's a contemporary gentleman who lives just north of Mount Shasta in California. His name is Eric Gonzalez, an amazing man. He's a Mayan daykeeper. I worked with him with Max. We've talked about crystal skulls. He came to my crystal skull lecture in Mount Shasta last year. He also said to me that as far as he knew, there was no Mayan legend tradition of 13 skulls that had to come together. Again, it doesn't mean that there isn't one. I'm just saying that this suddenly has become very popular in only the last 10 to 15 years. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not true, but we all
saw visions. No, it doesn't mean that. And another problem is that the real shamans don't talk too much.
Exactly.
So It's not
exactly.
Always, you know, they don't come out with little. My experience with the Mayan shamans is that they say very little, and with any shamans, you are the one who is to understand simply by being in the energy. So my story, which I'd like to share with you, is this. I went to Palenque. As you said, 10 years ago I was writing about it, about this circle of 13, but the truth is that before I was writing about it, I was already, you know, collecting my crystal skulls here. Mm-hmm. At any rate, 2005, I brought a group of people with me, as I take groups like you do, to mm-hmm. Palenque. And when I set off for this program, I told people that we would be doing a crystal skull ceremony at Palenque and that we would be uniting the skulls, the 12 crystal skulls. But what was interesting was I kept hearing from my Syrian guides the message, call in the 13th, call mm-hmm. in the 13th. And I heard this over and over and over again and decided that I guess I was supposed to bring 12 crystal skulls and somehow maybe there would be a hologram that would appear in the middle of the circle and whatever. So I started acquiring and assembling 12 skulls to bring to Mexico. And what happened was the guide was not clear that I had no specific idea of how I wanted to run this ceremony. So he said, don't you have some kind of a format or, you know, as a Mayan traditional ceremony, how do you want to do this? I said, I'll know when it happens.
Right.
So we were at the site, started to rain, and he ran over to get shelter, and he ran into the father of the shaman of Palenque, whose name is Cayun. And this man asked him what he was doing there and made small talk, and he said, I've got this crazy woman who's doing a tour, and she's got people from all over the world, and she's got skulls. And the man said, skulls, crystal skulls.
Uh-huh.
Skulls? And he said, yeah, she's going to do a crystal skull ceremony. And he said, how many skulls does she have with her? And he said, 12. And he said, hold it right here. And out comes Cayun, and he made him reiterate the whole story. And Cayun said, who is this woman? Where is she from? He was trying to find out where I was from because he had had a vision, or he said it was a prophecy, that I was going to come with 12 crystal skulls. But this man kept telling him I was from Italy. And Cayun believed that I was from North America. And when he finally said, no, wait, she's not from Italy, she's from California, Cayun said, okay, I will bring the 13th. And he presented himself that night to my very fortunate group of people with this big Mayan skull.
Wow.
And it's cool. Like, you know, I said, I've got a surprise for you, everybody. In comes Cayun with this skull. And, of course, this was calling in the 13th. And we did a ceremony in Palenque with Cayun directing this ceremony. And in the end, he gave a gift to me, which was another skull that he had that had been in the family for generations. And he said that it was ordained.
That just shows how connected you are. You see, this is what I'm saying is that this is right. I say even myself, I, working with the Mayan crystal skull in 1980, I saw a scene of 12 in a circle, the Master 13th. When I saw it, and others also saw the same scene, they were 12 different colors. They were green, like jade. They were red, like ruby. They were
right,
yellow,
and that's interesting, because
like
I've
citrine.
Got 12 different colors here in my temple, here in my house.
You see, this is real. Okay.
This
now,
is. I've got
is,
citrus quartz. I've
saw,
got one that's ruby.
Other people
straight. It's too much, man.
But the idea of there being 13 original skulls from Atlantis, that's the only thing. 13, and people are using that now. There are people running around the world saying, I have one of the original 13 skulls. You know, and again, as I mentioned in the book, Nick Nocerino saw anywhere from 15 to 18 skulls that he would have classified as genuine ancient. So what we believe is there were sets of 13. Now, whether people want to, you know, it's okay. I mean, I'm not telling you to be wrong. I'm not telling you to back away from your channelings at all. If you see, and you still continue to see 13 skulls from Atlantis, that's no problem. But it's when people say to me that there are only 13 original ones, and then everybody, you know, that we...
No,
I mean,
well, let me interject
as
here.
As I can tell you,
only
tell
is
you,
a word that has to disappear when you're talking about metaphysical. Because
and
there
again,
is no
there,
only.
And again, we say the word ancient in over 1,000 years. So that means a crystal skull could have been carved 1,001 years ago, we would classify it as ancient, but another one could have been carved 15,000 years ago during the time of Atlantis, and that's also an ancient one. So there were sets of them, I'm convinced. And whether there was 13 original, you know, I'm not, Ken, there's supposed to be 13 original from Tibet as well. And again, I find in your book, Atlantis Rising, if I just substitute for the word Atlantis, Kemet, I have no problem with anything that you change, you understand?
You are such a Kemetian, it is unbelievable.
And Papa would have been the same way. Everything that you say from Atlantis in the book, and anything that's channeled, and there's some wonderful channelings there, that for 10 years ago, you know, here we are 10 years later, certainly warning about the New World Order, about this and about HAARP and about global change, all of that. And particularly about diet, I found very interesting, because I've been a vegetarian, partial vegetarian since 1972, I haven't eaten red meat or chicken, became a total vegetarian in 1988. And here, you know, the Syrian elders are telling us, oh, okay, I've been doing the right thing by, you know, living higher on the food chain, lower on the food chain.
Yeah.
And
well,
so,
the truth
that,
is that, in fact, thank you for acknowledging the book.
Kemet, if I just substitute Kemet for Atlantis, I have no problems with anything.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Well,
the point
it's
is,
not to say that it... that we, well, first of all, it really, in my opinion, it really doesn't matter. In yours, it does, of course, because you're an archaeologist.
Right.
But when we're talking about the ancient world... I think it kind of was going to be, if we ever get to it, we're going to see that it's all a swirl. There's no boundaries. There's no fine lines to divide nations or countries as we perceive them today.
Right. It's just that
borders that we perceive today most likely were very, very differently drawn back then.
And the fact is we were much more advanced over 15,000 years ago spiritually than we are today, and that's what a lot of people are finding out. And I believe there were a lot of cultures who were producing. Again, as I said, we look at them at different gradations. Now, I would tell you the Mayan skull, the amethyst skull, I classify them as ancient, but when I came across Max and Shana-Ra, they're much, much older. Now, these guys, if somebody said, well, these are two of the originals. Well, they're certainly two of the oldest I've ever come across. Both Max and Shana-Ra, Shana-Ra being Nick Nocerino's skull, Max being the Texas skull we can talk about, they're both definitely carved as skulls over 10,000 years ago. So there you're talking
really?
About Atlantis prime. Yes.
10,000
oh, yes.
years?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Cool. That's very interesting.
There's no way anybody in contemporary times carved Max or Shana-Ra. And I believe that they were carved by the Olmecs. Now, you see, the Olmecs were the mother civilization to the Maya. The Maya claimed that they descended from the Olmecs. Nobody knows how old the Olmecs really are. They're very, very confusing to the archaeologists who keep pushing them further back, but they can't believe the Olmecs could do what they could do, like they could do in ancient Kemet. I mean, you have the Olmec, if you've ever been to La Venta or Veracruz, there are these great stone heads out of basalt that were carved by the Olmec that look like the West African sailors. They're definitely African-looking people.
They're definitely African-looking Negro
creatures. Carved well over 10,000 years ago out of 50-ton blocks of basalt. And so it's the same technology as ancient Kemet. And my dear, dear friend Chris Dunn is going to be coming out with a new book showing that there were advanced machining technologies and stone carving all around the world over 10,000 years ago. We see it in India.
I know. Listen, Stephen. We are already at the end of our hour. Would you believe that?
So it's going to have to be
part
one.
So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to have to say goodbye for the radio hour, and I'm going to see if we can just come back and do another hour, because you and I, we're just getting heated here.
Oh, yeah. It has to be more than one part. You knew that.
Yeah. So you stay on the line with me, and let's say to everybody, as you can see, Stephen Mailer and I are soul flames, or what? I can't even think of a name for it. Let's just say we are from the same family, and when we get going, it's just like, whoosh! This is a man whose book you've got to read, and all of his books are very important. He is a pure soul. Again, it's Stephen Mailer, our guest tonight, and I'm going to keep him on the line after the show goes, and we're going to see if we can just tape the next one so that we can continue where we've left off, because as you can see, Stephen and I are just getting heated up about the Crystal Skull story. So stay tuned, everyone. If you've enjoyed this first conversation. We'll call it Crystal Skulls Part 1 with Stephen Mailer. Check back in, and I will check my website, and I'll let you know when the second segment is going to air. So, of course, you know it's SyrianRevelations.net, and my guest, Stephen Mailer. Stephen, do we want to give a website for you before we disconnect?
Yes. Yeah, so the best website is the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. It's www.gizapyramid.com, and I'm the director of research.
Okay, great. All right, everybody, that's it for now. And if Stephen, if you'll stay on the line with me, we will see what
sure.
we can do to keep talking. Okay, thanks, everybody. It's been great. And remember, keep your mind free out of the quagmire of the Matrix. Ciao, ciao, everyone, and I'll be with you next week.